Hello, I'm Cara Dahl-Russell. This March, after the news at noon on WSCL, we celebrate Women's History Month, stepping back to the years 1000 to 1200 to explore the development of songs of love and music of devotion in our series, Courtly Love and the Cult of the Virgin, each weekday after the news at noon here on WSCL Salisbury. Hello, I'm Cara Dahl-Russell. We continue our series, Courtly Love and the Cult of the Virgin, with today our topic being Persian love poetry. This week we're considering some of the cultural elements that combine to set the stage for the concept of courtly love. Yesterday we discussed the isolation of individual castles within a kingdom, each having its own fairly autonomous rule. And while a woman's status was still generally defined through her father or husband, women were also legally set apart, and some women held their own businesses, and a very lucky few came to power through the absence of a husband at war or as regent to an underage son. For many centuries, a broad swath of southern Europe had been diverse and multicultural, primarily through the necessity of trade routes by both land and water. Settlements along these routes and the resulting flow of goods, slaves, tradesmen, emissaries, and the interplay of cultural elements, food, music, and intellectual exchange. As the nobility and royalty began to intermarry to solidify their political, geographic, and financial advantages, these cultural influences spread northward in Europe through the 1000s. Today we focus on one particular cultural influence, Persian love poetry. In particular, the story of Vist and Ramin. This story is generally conceded to be the origin of the story Tristan and Isolde. And while the best-known version of this story was a verse romance written in the year 1000 by poet Fakir al-Din Asad Jorjani, it is known that the tale dates back at least to the year 700, when it is mentioned by the Arab poet Abu Nawas. In the story, King Mobad of Marv is in love with Saru, the queen of Ma. She refuses his offer of marriage, but promises him that if she has a girl child, that child will be given to him as a bride. She does have a girl. That girl is Vis, and she is brought up in the court of Mobad, alongside his younger brother, Ramin. Like the tales of Scheherazade, these stories were meant to take up many evenings, so the tale has many convoluted turns, including a first unconsummated marriage of Vis to another king, a war, the discovery that Vis loves Ramin, her banishment, a trial by fire to prove her chastity, an escape, the nurse of Vis sneaking in to take the place of Vis in Mobad's bed at night, Ramin scaling a wall to save Vis from imprisonment. Are you noticing scenes here that were later used by Shakespeare? Still, more wars, more separation and trials ensue, but eventually our plucky heroine and our volatile and loyal hero are married and enjoy a fruitful 2 sons and long 80-year reign together. And finally, when she dies, he mourns at her tomb for 2 years until they are united together in the tomb for eternity. So here we have a well-known story from centuries ago being written down in the year 1000 as another element of the international social climate. A story of lovers fighting and succeeding against an arranged marriage and against social norms. The romance and longing joined with many scenes at night, adding to the atmosphere of danger, romance, and intrigue. Our hero is also regularly proving himself in battle. In this essential retelling of the story, we also have open and frank, but not prurient, inclusion of natural elements of sexuality, including impotence, menstruation, and childbirth. These elements give the story cross-cultural relevance. Bear in mind that this is a culture where kings had harems, but in this story, the overriding love of one woman lifts her up above other women, and the overriding loyal love is lifted above the promises of kings or religion or morality. all of this, wrapped in the verbal arabesques of floral love poetry that would not be found again in art until the Rococo period. This intoxicating mix of adventure and romance influenced the extended songs and stories of the contemporary troubadours that we will explore tomorrow, another element in the basic culture that set the stage for the concepts and practices of courtly love. Today we will hear traditional Persian music, luscious love songs of composer Didi Efendi, who lived from 1778 to 1846, but worked with older musical forms and traditional Persian instruments. Beautifully Singing Nightingale and A Lovely Rose. The lyrics of both evoke the poetry of courtly love. Beautifully singing nightingale, keep your homage everywhere apt. I am your servant. Be gentle with me. A lovely rose I admired. My heart still clings to you, O my charming maiden, my deep brown sweetheart, my graceful dark beauty, my amber clad, O my charming maiden, my heart's magnet, O you with your pearl-white teeth, you are clothed with hyacinths, O my charming maiden. Hello, I'm Cara Dahl Russell. We continue our series, After the News at Noon, Courtly Love and the Cult of the Virgin. Today, returning to a woman that we have mentioned several times already, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Born in 1122, Eleanor was the daughter and heiress of William X, Duke of Aquitaine and Count of Poitiers. She was well-educated in literature, philosophy, languages, and court life by William. After her father's death, at age 15, Eleanor inherited the duchy title of Aquitaine and one of the largest domains in France, effectively becoming the most sought-after bride in Europe. Shortly afterwards, she was given the protection of the royal family, and she was married at age 15 to Louis VII of France in 1137. She held her queenly title for 15 years and had two children with Louis. The infidelity of Louis was common knowledge, and the infidelity of Eleanor was widely rumored. Louis was increasingly criticized politically, while Eleanor became known as intelligent and capable. Different sources attribute their annulment as being sought by both, but it is notable that both of their children were girls, and kings wanted sons. In a worthy precursor to the marriages of Henry VIII 500 years later, their annulment was granted in 1152, and their two daughters were left to the king. It is important to know that Eleanor of Aquitaine was a follower of a heretic group called the Cathars, and one important part of Catharism was that women were considered equally capable of being spiritual leaders because of their belief that self-denial of the material world with a focus on the spirit as opposed to the body. So the body of the leader didn't matter. For a woman who had rank, power, and intellect, the ability of a female follower of Catharism to become a perfect of the faith and to establish group homes for women, there was an undeniable allure, and the spread of Catharism was strong among the nobility. Early and fairly ineffective versions of the Catholic Inquisitions were going on in this time period, at least in part due to Catharism. Hildegard von Bingen spoke against Catharism in 1163 in Cologne, where she announced a state of eternal punishment and damnation to all those who accepted Cathar beliefs. As far as her marriages were concerned, Eleanor may indeed have felt the sting of eternal punishment. She retained her property after her annulment and became again a highly sought-after prize. Only a month after the annulment of her marriage to Louis, she was married to Henry, Duke of Normandy and Count of Anjou, and after the death of King Stephen soon after, the two were crowned King and Queen of England. Despite having 8 children together, including the requisite male heirs, they also had difficulties. Henry was also known for flagrant infidelities, and Eleanor was even implicated in the death of one of his mistresses. As with Louis, it is known that Henry also mistrusted Eleanor's manipulations for power, including her known attempts to influence her sons to usurp their father. The infighting of their sons and their marital strife are the stuff of legend and were immortalized in James Goldman's 1966 play, The Lion in Winter. In 1167, Eleanor separated from Henry and moved back to Poitiers, where the establishment of the legendary Court of Love began in the court of Henri I, Count of Champagne. Henri was married to Eleanor's eldest daughter, Marie de Champagne, in whom we see the fruition of all of these cultural elements. Marie was the patroness of the French poet Chrétien de Troyes, one of the main authors of chivalric tales, whose work Lancelot mentioned the name Camelot for the first time. The family had always valued arts. Eleanor's uncle, William, was the first known troubadour poet. Together, the two women attracted a cultural phenomenon of troubadours, writers, artists, symbolic ritual, and the rules and manners of courtly life, which became known as the Court of Love. Marie's court played a role in the spread of courtly love throughout Europe, and it was Marie who actually commissioned Andreas Kapelenius, Chaplain André, to write the chivalric code and the art of courtly love, by which we have the historic record of courtly love as an actual code of behavior above and beyond the songs of love and longing. Hello, I'm Cara Dahl-Russell, and we continue our After the News at Noon series, Courtly Love and the Cult of the Virgin, with today's discussion of pop songs of the Virgin Mary. Today, we're going to hear a timeline of songs of veneration to the Virgin Mary from the time of our series to Monteverdi and then to Verdi. The ones that we will hear are mostly clear in the divinity of the Virgin Mary and her position within the Catholic hierarchy of veneration. But as you know from some of the selections we played last week, many songs to the Virgin Mary were not so clearly religious. Music within the church can often be a source of contention in almost any denomination. Just as Bach dedicated all of his works to the glory of God, musicians in churches today want to bring their highest talent and best musical knowledge to the worship service. Unfortunately, many times the pastoral staff will have either a limited appreciation or knowledge of the music, or have preferences which may be much more traditional. And often that means music that was written over 100 years ago. From the other point of view, music is often pointed to as an unnecessary source of dissension in the church and a distraction from the word. During the Gregorian period of music, that was the reason for no instruments in church. It was felt that all things in the service, including the music, had to extol the word, and that meant only vocal music.